and we had a small valise of photos and clothes. It's all we had. Tears ran again. I couldn't tell if she was crying over the photos, or Vietnam, or both. My father was trying to save more pictures, while my brother and I comforted my mother as best as we could. He didn't show any discernible emotion, focused on what he could fix or try to fix. "Who's this baby?" Lou gestured toward the ugly baby photo lying on the table. "That's Phúc. Look at him," my mother chirped. "Look at him. What a baby." "He looks weird, like he's angry or something," Lou joked, to which I responded with a short jab to his arm. "Ow!" My mother ignored the punch as she looked at the photos spread out on the table, a dozen photos that had the likelihood of being salvaged. "Did you know that Phúc was talking at 1 year old? He could count. It's true. So smart." I stuck my tongue out at my brother in mock triumph. "Sounds about right. I am a genius. You guys just don't recognize it," I said. "What about you, Lou? You're the one who Mom put in a dress. A girl's dress." My brother hated that story, and I mentioned it to get a rise out of him. "Shut up. That was when I was a baby," Lou punched back. My mom tried to de-escalate our jostling. "Well, it was the only clothes people donated to us. We didn't have any other clothes that fit Lou except for girls' clothes when we came to this country. And it only happened a few times." "Yeah, you stopped putting him in dresses when Lou showed his wiener." He ignored me this time. My father got up from the table, abandoning the photos. "Let's get back to the basement. We still have to clean up the water." In Vietnamese, the word for country and the word for water are the same. Nước. Context obviously makes it clear if you're talking about the former or the latter, but in Vietnamese, your country is not the terra firma or the nationality. It's the water. The waters that feed the soil. The waters that lap your shores. If you ask someone where they're from, you're asking them literally, from what waters do they come? The country of America is called, in Vietnamese, Nước Mỹ, the waters of America. I've wondered why water was a synonym with country, but a quick look at Vietnam's geography seems to hint at its origin. Vietnam's 2,000-mile coastline, thousands of islands, massive rivers and deltas, the waters that flow through Vietnam, the monsoons that mark its seasons between rainy and dry, waters run its length, slice through it, define it. Its waters were so prominent to its primordial people that water defined where you came from. Water was your country. Lou, my father, and I all carried buckets upon buckets of water up the steps and out the door, long past midnight, and we mopped up the rest of the basement. The kitchen clock blinked 2 a.m. when we finished. Our new home had ironically destroyed the mementos of our old life. Or maybe it wasn't ironic. Maybe our new home had to destroy the old things. Maybe that destruction had already begun, and we didn't know it. Old water, new water. Old country, new country. Aqua vitae, giver of life, destroyer of memories. At the end of Pygmalion, Eliza laments that she cannot go back to her old life, to her old ways, and she cannot find a place in her new world either. In the currents of fitting in the push and pull of Americana that was sweeping me and my brother away, I could no longer communicate deeply with my parents. I had begun to forget my Vietnamese, and that act of forgetting was my Vietnamese forfeiture for my future in America. The slow erosion of our common language didn't happen with a cataclysmic flood. It was the gradual, imperceptible rise in the tides. One moment, I couldn't remember the word for plaid. Then, I began to forget words that I should have known. And then, I didn't ask to learn them when I did forget. Sometimes, in annoyance, I chose to answer my mother in English, bypassing Vietnamese altogether. I didn't bother to consider what was lost in the undertow of the flood. I was in the waters of America, and gasping, dying, I chose to survive. I held my breath and dove deeper. Chapter 8. The Metamorphosis. Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis is a simple story. Gregor Samsa awakes to find himself transformed into a giant bug. When he discovers that he's a giant bug, he immediately looks at the clock and thinks about which train he can still catch to get to work on time. By himself, he's not freaking out about being a giant roach at all. His parents and sister, whom he's been supporting, freak out. His supervisor from work shows up and freaks out. Gregor has turned into a bug, but he does not freak out about his transformation until he has to navigate his relationships with his family and his work supervisor. You read the metamorphosis and you realize it's his family's ugliness towards Gregor that moves the story. Gregor is now a giant roach, and he cannot do anything about it. His family, instead of acting with compassion and kindness, sends Gregor to his room and locks the door. What's worse than turning into a giant bug? Turning into a giant bug and having your family act like a bunch of assholes. And isn't that adolescence? A biological change over which we have no control? And then our family, like a bunch of assholes, treats us like an insect in the midst of a metamorphosis that we ourselves hardly understand. Suddenly, with a different focus from the perspective of a bug, we see who they are. September 1988, Phillips House. A bunch of us punks and skaters gathered on Sunday at Philip Lehman's house to watch his band practice. Philip and three friends had formed the first punk band in our crew, Bundersplat. In his basement, the foursome churned out songs that were loud and angry, with titles like Prejudicial Prosecution, Breaking Down the Walls, and Do You Wanna Fuck? Philip's dad, a wiry middle-aged man with glasses, greeted us with a warm hello when we arrived for band practice. After exchanging pleasantries about school, we retreated to the basement. Mr. Lehman allowed smoking in the practice space, and in the murky, poorly lit rumbling cellar, we gathered around Bundersplat, pushing one another, bobbing our heads, binding our tribe. The thudding music made the cellar concrete throb and hum. Philip was a year ahead of me in 11th grade, and he commanded everyone's respect in the punk scene. His older brother, Lucas, who had graduated 4 years earlier, was, according to Carlisle punk annals, the first punk rocker in our town. The epic mythos surrounding Lucas Lehman was hyperbolic. Lucas shaved and glued his hair into an 8-inch mohawk, dyed it red even. We referred to Lucas as if we were talking about Paul Bunyan or John Henry. And with his legendary mohawk, he had gone to NYU. Fucking New York University. Our crew only had the dimmest gleanings about what our lives might look like after high school. We were too preoccupied with hooliganism, next week's party, or where to meet girls. We didn't know much about college. But there went Lucas, to the city. The city. And he had moved there to go to college. No, not college. University. We'd see him home from New York, and Lucas would fire off stories about The Village, or Alphabet City, or Tompkins Square Park. As we gathered around him, children in awe of big city fireworks, oohing and aahing at his words bursting around us. Band practice ended that Sunday, and several of us headed out to skate for the rest of the afternoon. We invited Philip to come along. Still sweaty from rehearsal, Philip shook his head. Nah, I have a shit ton of homework already for AP US History. My antennae swiveled at this remark. Philip was turning down hangout time to do homework. We all heard what he said, and everyone else lobbed a cool before they took off. No one would give Philip shit for anything, even for choosing homework over hangout. I lingered behind as the other guys left. AP US History? What's AP? Advanced Placement US History. Mrs. Romberger teaches it. She's amazing. Fucking Pat Romberger. Philip's face widened with a big grin and raised brows, using Mrs. Romberger's first name, Pat, as if they were old friends. AP US is great. I was flabbergasted. This was Philip Lehman, and he was glowing about high school, about AP US history. Yeah, you should definitely take it next year. Plus, if you do well on the AP tests, you can get college credit. Just do your work and study. You can't get shitty grades if you want to get into AP classes. Huh, good to know. I had never heard of the AP, nor had I ever heard one of my friends express unequivocal love for school or a class. Hang on a sec. You like The Cure, right? He wiped his sweaty forehead with the hem of his t-shirt. Yeah, The Cure? They're all right. I answered warily, because I never knew with Philip if it would turn into an insult or not. Wait here. He bounded upstairs and came back down. Read this. He handed me a black paperback, a copy of The Stranger by Albert Camus. This is the book that inspired their song, Killing an Arab. Give it back to me after you finish, okay? Philip lent me a book. Holy fuck. Not a record, not a cassette tape, not a movie. A book. I didn't even know that he liked reading. I looked at the back, skimming the blurb. Influential, terrifying, unrelenting grip. Yeah, cool. Camus, I said aloud, butchering the name. It's French, man. Camus. Philip snickered as I blushed with a searing embarrassment, the still present and perennial humiliation of pronouncing things incorrectly. Oh, okay. Camus. Got it. How do you say his first name? How the fuck do I know? Probably just fucking Albert. It would be a while before I learned how to say Albert Camus. I hopped on my skateboard to catch up to the other guys, calling out another thank you as I skated away. Philip seemed different to me now, and our conversation sparked a revelation about both Philip and me. I had assumed that being punk and being good at school were antithetical to each other, that the first rule of rebellion was revolt against monolithic institutions like school. That part was right. Our brand of punk was anti-school. But I had conflated anti-school with anti-education. Philip proved, in that moment, my assumptions were bullshit. I skated along, surprised at how excited I was to read The Stranger. I had naively assumed that Philip's older brother, Lucas, had gone on to NYU because of natural ability and luck. Who knew? I had only the vaguest notions of how you got into college, and figured most of us who could get in would go to one of the Penn State campuses. I was now beginning to realize that maybe Lucas had worked and studied hard to get into a good school, rather than getting in by pure luck. At school, I was doing well. My parents and I had negotiated an arrangement that allowed me to hang out late on weekends, stay on the honor roll, no curfew. I met my parents' expectations with ease, but I wasn't kicking or pushing myself particularly hard. Regardless, I had kept my academic work to myself, hidden from my friends to better fit in with them, or with who I thought they were. Yet here Philip was, telling me not to be a dummy, to do my work, and to study. Could you love reading and still love punk? I had assumed that you couldn't be a skate punk and geek out on books, but Philip had changed that perspective. I had wanted to ensure that I would fit in and suppressed my nerdiness as anathema to punk rock. But Philip had obliterated that premise in an instant with a copy of The Stranger. Maybe this was my opportunity to be regarded as someone different, more interesting and complicated than the Vietnamese kid or a skate punk. It began here, a borrowed book because of a song. This was my invitation to be something more complex. This small seedling moment would grow into my opportunity to change and flourish, to branch out with new ideas and shear away old assumptions. October 1988, the MJ Mall. Connor and I had a shift together at the Coral Reef that Sunday. The Coral Reef was a tropical tiki-themed smoothie bar in the middle of the MJ Mall. Even on its busiest days, the mall's architectural expanse made it feel cavernous and half-occupied. Two kiosks squatted in the middle of the oversized concourse, a novelty t-shirt booth where you could custom order t-shirts with black velvet bubble lettering that extolled your status as world's number one grandpa, and the Coral Reef, with fake plastic palm trees flanking its four corners, a thatched roof, and a dusty, shellacked blowfish that hung dejectedly by the yellow sign. The Coral Reef was an incongruous vendor in the MJ Mall. It was a typical Sunday at the mall. I didn't feel like doing chemistry homework, so I pulled out The Myth of Sisyphus by Camus while Connor cleaned the counters. I had already finished The Stranger, amazing and horrifying in its nihilism, and went to the library to get another book. I looked up Camus in the encyclopedia. French, existentialist, didn't believe in God, died in a car crash. The latter two items probably unrelated. The encyclopedia mentioned him in tandem with Sartre, and I decided that I wanted to read him or her too. What kind of a name was Jean Paul anyway? Clueless, I picked the shortest book on the library shelves, a slim play called No Exit. The book jacket informed me that Jean-Paul Sartre was a man, but it didn't present me with a pronunciation guide for how to say Sartre. Shit. I would just have to avoid saying Sartre and only refer to the play title, No Exit. No way was I going to embarrass myself pronouncing Sartre. I piled No Exit on top of The Myth of Sisyphus, light reading for a 14-year-old, and tucked them both away in my backpack. There I sat at the coral reef on Sunday, reading Sisyphus. The hot dog cooker rolled the shriveled hot dogs in unison. They churned endlessly, cooked beyond recognition, dimpled with sweat and oil. Yet, with all their rolling, they went nowhere. Yup, that looked like existentialism, all right. Connor nudged me. What are you reading? Camus? It's French. Camus. Dude, you should read this book. It's about why you shouldn't kill yourself. Seriously, I don't need a book to tell me that. Laughter. Yeah, he says that life is absurd. It makes no sense, has no meaning. Camus asks why we shouldn't just all kill ourselves. So crazy. Why shouldn't I then? I don't know yet. I'll tell you when I get to the end. Well, read faster. You're fucking bumming me out. I read on as he straightened the condiments. 3 o'clock, shift over. Kevin, the manager, came and relieved us from reef duty. Connor and I hopped into the front seat of his parents' cobalt blue Ford Escort station wagon. Where are we going? I don't know. Want to just drive around? Roy got me a 12-pack of National Bohemian. Seriously? I assumed he was joking, but he reached back behind my seat, nudging aside a blanket to reveal a tattered white cardboard box of warm beer. Presto. You already did your homework. What else do you have to do? Connor's rhetoric was compelling. Did I think twice about drinking in the middle of the afternoon? Did I consider what coming home, a little drunk to my parents for Sunday dinner at 6 p.m. would look like? Of course I didn't. We didn't think far enough ahead to save the beer for a party. Never mind the next weekend. Are you kidding me? Yeah, let's do it. Boredom short-circuited any forethought, and beer in hand did so, doubly. The regularity of drinking had made us cavalier and careless. We had never been caught, and I assumed that whatever suspicions Connor's parents might have harbored were met with a blind eye, probably because he was the youngest of four siblings. It seemed they'd given up the cat-and-mouse routine of parent and teen pursuit. My parents, on the other hand, didn't have even a sliver of a notion about American teenage culture and underage drinking. The idea that I might be drinking warm beer in a Ford Escort never crossed their minds. Fuck! Fuck, 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 fuck! Connor rattled off suddenly while pulling the car over. I figured we had a flat tire or he had forgotten something. What is it? Then I saw in the rear view, police lights. We pulled over and the police officer approached our window. License, registration, out of the car. Problem, officer? Beer can, son? Beer? What beer? We were in the back of the squad car, on our way to the police station. Our parents were also on their way, icebergs and ocean liners plotting their courses of intersection. In the interrogation room, when they asked me where we got the beer, we found it, sir. I felt oddly calm. No panic. I could only control my reaction to what was going to happen. They asked to go through the contents of my backpack. No drugs in there, sir. And I spread my belongings out on the table. Notebooks, a couple of pencils, chemistry textbook, Camus, Sartre, No Exit. From the police station, my family and I endured a wordless car ride home. Officially, I was given a warning, sealed records unless further violations were made, for which future violations I would be referred to juvenile court. Keep my nose clean. Yes, sir. No, sir. I swear we found the beer, sir. No one bought it for us, sir. As I rode home in the back seat with my brother, the tranquility I had felt at the station gurgled into anxiety. What did you do? Lou whispered. I got caught driving around with Connor and drinking beer. I didn't look at my brother. Beer? Why were you drinking beer? Lou was dumbfounded. I stared out the car window, unable to twist any farther away from him. I didn't answer. I was sent to my room when we got home, and my parents talked in the kitchen while my brother went into the living room and played Nintendo. I put on a dubbed tape of The Cure on my boombox and sat in my chair, staring blankly. The head on the door played on the A side. I was fucked. How was I not? Whatever drunkenness I had felt dissipated. The beers were still in my gut, but now congealed into a bezoar of unease and anticipation. I also kind of needed to take a shit. I was going to get grounded. I was trying to guess for how long. Maybe a few weeks? The Vegas odds. I was wagering several weeks. 4? 5? That seemed like a good punishment. My parents called me into the kitchen. There was no yelling or screaming. They both spoke, so I knew it was serious because my mother never weighed in as a disciplinarian. As they spoke, my father Englished, my mother Vietnamesed, and their dialogue diverged into two radio stations broadcasting simultaneously. I stared, downcast, into the dead air between them, the broken tuner, receiving English on the left channel and Vietnamese on the right.
Honey, you know that you shouldn't drink beer.
This is very bad that the police,
you're too little,
caught you, and we are very lucky.
You're just so young that you did not have to go to jail. Some people drink beer when they're older. Do you know how much shame this brings on the family? But not as a kid. It's terrible. Don't drink beer, okay?
Was this Connor's idea?
I know that you just wanted to try it.
You shouldn't be friends with him anymore.
But don't drink beer, okay?
I think he's a bad influence. You're grounded for 6 months. My father's slender hands crossed on the table. My mother nodded, head wilting with a drawn expression, leaving the discipline to my father. Short and sweet. No prelude. No long conversation about disappointment. Just the sentencing. The grammar of justice in my parents' house was brief and declarative. Grounded for 6 months. I didn't think this was the appropriate time to try to plea bargain. Okay. I was grounded from October through April, a lot longer than the few weeks I'd been expecting. I went back to my room, closed my door, and sat in my faded yellow corduroy reading chair. The Cure was playing the song The Caterpillar on my boombox. I flopped onto my bed, staring out my window and thinking about my sentence when my perspective shifted. I looked at my bedroom window, but instead of a window, I saw a door. Was I trapped in my room like Gregor Samsa? No, I wasn't. The next day at school, Liam Mahoney caught up with me at my locker.
Dude, did you and Connor get arrested?
Yeah, it sucked. Rode in the back of the cop car and everything. I delivered it as lackadaisically as I could, glossing over any fear and panic that I had felt when I was waiting for my parents in the holding area. Our escapade already had its own momentum. I didn't need to sell my story with teenage histrionics. Nonchalance was my agent, and she sold it for me.
Damn, that's crazy. I want to hear about it later. Hey, do you have your gym socks?
I don't have white socks, and I'm going to fail gym if I don't have them. It'll be the third time this marking period. Liam was referring to our school's mandatory gym uniform, a white t-shirt, green shorts, white socks, light-soled sneakers, and a jock strap.
Oh yeah, sure.
I handed Liam white socks from the bottom of my locker, where my gym uniform lay, unwashed and odorous.
Hey, thanks. Sorry about you and Connor getting busted.
Later. My white socks in hand, he was off to gym. In geometry class later that day, Mr. O'Hara was in the midst of telling us a terrible joke about his friend who worked in Alaska, canning fish. My friend was the cook for all the cannery guys, and all the workers slept in tents. While they were there, he had befriended some dolphins that would swim up to them on the coast for the leftovers. After this happened a few times, my buddy, the cook, woke up one morning, rang the bell, and yelled out, "Breakfast is being served for all in tents and porpoises." We groaned in mock disdain for the pun, but all our faces were wide with laughter. Mr. O'Hara's dark beard was covered in chalk and spittle as he laughed loudest and longest. Jim Taylor, who sat near me in most of my classes by virtue of the alphabetical seating chart, turned around, word of our arrest was making its way through the school. "Hey, are you grounded for 6 months?" The rumor mill worked fast at Carlisle High School. "Yeah, Connor and I got busted for drinking." I tried not to sound like I was bragging, but I was bragging. Jim's eyes bulged with my affirmation. I walked through the halls that week thinking that, in my wake, kids were whispering and pointing. Maybe they weren't, but in my own mind, I had moved up a peg in rebel status with an arrest and sealed police file. Maybe they saw me differently, but I certainly saw myself differently. I hadn't turned into a giant bug. This was a different kind of revolting. I was a full-blown teen rebel now. 6 months of being grounded could have been a crippling blow to my social life, but in fact, it amplified my social standing because I snuck out every weekend, which gave me even more social cachet and augmented my rebel status. Being grounded granted me confidence and credibility. My classmates asked me about it, and I was always poised to tell them. And when I showed up at punk shows or house parties, I was always met with a three-part harmony of, "I thought you were grounded." "I am grounded. Where's the beer?" Laughing and hand clasping. Beer cans in our fists, hissing open with quick fissures. What had I learned from my arrest and subsequent grounding? Don't drink in a place that you can't run from like a car. And be thankful that your bedroom is easy to sneak out of. If only Gregor had been able to see a life beyond his room, his home, and his family. I flitted about in school, doing only slightly more than the minimum for my classes, though I now had more time at home than I had before. Philip's injunction about AP US history and school was planted in my mind, but it grew no firm roots and bore no fruits. My motivations at school were to maintain my grades so that when I was eventually paroled, I could go back to hanging with my crew, to skating, to going to shows without sneaking around in the underbrush of lies. In English class, Mrs. Ferguson was dragging the class's discussion through third period, straining heroically against the inertia of kids who hadn't read Great Expectations. At some point in the discussion, Mrs. Ferguson mentioned something about the search for meaning in one's life. My ears perked up. Remembering what I had read about Camus, I raised my hand. "It sounds like it's a common question, those big questions about meaning in life. It's a theme that shows up a lot, right? Like in the existentialist writers, like Camus and, Sartre? Life is absurd. That's their take, at least, on the meaning of life." I overpronounced Camus and stumbled over Sartre's name, pronouncing it more like Tartar. But I remembered a little about the existentialists, and I was cocksure that I had pronounced Camus correctly. Mrs. Ferguson tilted her head. "Yes, I suppose that's true. It does have a connection with many other great books." She was gracious, given that I had anachronistically shoehorned an allusion about French existentialism into a Victorian English novel. I leaned forward at her observation that I had read a great book on my own, and I felt the class's energy turn toward me. Even my listless peers stopped their doodling and looked up. "Fouque, have you read much Camus or Sartre?" Mrs. Ferguson asked with apparent intrigue. "Just The Stranger, The Myth of Sisyphus, and No Exit, so far. But I just borrowed The Plague." I added the "so far," thinking that it sounded smart and hinted at an intent to read more, as vague and uncommitted as that intent was. She nodded approvingly. "Well, thanks for making that connection, Fouque. See me after class, please. I can recommend some other books for you if you like existentialism." A teenage boy who liked existentialism? She might as well have said that chocolate was delicious, or Freddie Mercury had a nice falsetto, or Dickens was wordy. Encouraged, I made a few more not-stupid remarks during our discussion, and after class, she scratched out some titles on the back of an old mimeographed vocabulary quiz. "You should read some of these works, too, if you like those other books you mentioned. It's a mix of novels and plays." I nodded gratefully as I read the list. Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. The Trial by Franz Kafka. "Thanks. I'll definitely check these out. At the library." Pun intended, you know. She laughed. Well, good. Keep reading and making those connections. That's what it's all about, the connection. I read the Beckett and Stoppard plays in quick succession and incorporated them in our class discussions when I could, my limited literary credentials of 5.5 books on existentialism being more than anyone else's reading list of none. No matter. My classmates gave me wide berth and listened with a respect that I had never been afforded, and Mrs. Ferguson checked in with me about my extracurricular reading. I was astounded and intoxicated by this shift in reality. What I read and what I said in the classroom mattered. It changed the way my classmates saw me, if they had seen me at all, and it changed the way my teacher saw me. And the truth was that I hadn't read that many books, nor was I some sonnet-quoting super genius of English literature. But I sounded like one, because I could refer to other books that I had voluntarily read, which apparently no one else did. Unsure of what else to read or what would sound impressive, I made certain to read our class's assigned books and whatever else Mrs. Ferguson recommended. I also figured that I could look up the authors in the library's encyclopedia just to be able to say something vaguely biographical about them in class discussions. My peers' esteem, which started bubbling in English class, boiled over into some of my other classes, and I happily rode the swells of admiration as my classmates realized that I wasn't some loser who was getting shit grades. The feeling that I had with my punk crew, that feeling of being part of something, that feeling of respect, had crept up in a place I wasn't expecting, the classroom. The sensation was fleeting, hard to pin down, but it felt real and complemented my crew's safeguard on the streets of our town. My classmates' open regard was public recognition of me and my intellect. Some kids seemed intimidated, and in my immaturity, their intimidation felt like respect, or something close enough for me. For the first time, I felt as though my peers were seeing another side of me, and this new side was earning their attention and esteem. It was a feeling that, at that moment, was completely unfamiliar to me. If I could command academic respect by reading 6 books, what would happen if I were to read 12? That fall and winter, I read everything I could, filling my name-dropping arsenal with Orwell, Bronte, Wolfe, Nietzsche, and whoever else was recommended. I savored the academic clout that reading a book gave me in school, and beyond that, I discovered that I actually liked the books my teachers recommended to me. My perceived need to read changed, slowly and surprisingly, into a desire to read, a desire that I didn't fight. December 1988, St. Patrick's Church. For my mother, Christmas Eve Mass was the culmination of her piety and devotion. All the Sundays, the extra Masses we attended on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, they all climaxed in December at midnight Mass. My mind wandered as it usually did at the other Masses, skipping from games of see people I know to thinking about song lyrics. I played a game where I tried to turn everything into a Smith's lyric. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the heir of a shyness that is criminally vulgar. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and in the midst of life we are in debt, etc. For us men and for our salvation, he came down from heaven, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. The chapel's lights dimmed as candles were fumbled in the dark. The liturgy ended as silent night swelled up from the choir and parishioners. The knot in my brow loosened. Usually, Sunday Mass was a mixture of boring and embarrassing. Boredom from the irrelevance that church and religion had for me. Embarrassment because it was the most public space that I was in with my family, and it was when I was most acutely aware of how much we didn't fit in. But Christmas Mass was different. It gave me a different lease on church and my family. In the dark of the church, one candle was lit from the front of the pews, and as the meager flame passed itself on, one small glimmer of light spread itself across the pews, dipping, catching, lighting, like twilight stars ascending. In the gloaming of the service, we were silhouettes, all of us, all our features and differences erased. In the darkness, everyone looked the same, and I didn't think about being the only Vietnamese family in the congregational sea of white families. In the darkness of midnight mass, we were the same as everyone else. I breathed in the warm smell of wicks and wax and listened. Silent night. Barely awake when we got home, Lou and I gathered around the Christmas tree to open gifts before our drive the next day to Staten Island. My parents, ever the pragmatists, had given up on getting us actual presents a few years ago, per our request, and gave us money in envelopes to buy the gifts we wanted. Hey, $50. Hey, me too. All right. I had seen an ad in the Village Voice for a cool pair of boots, and Ulysses S. Grant was going to help me procure them. There's another present for you in your room. My mother patted me on the shoulder. Really? What? I was well beyond bikes with ribbons, and given my current state of home incarceration, I wasn't sure what it could be. I padded down the hall in my socks, my parents behind me, and opened my bedroom door. It was a stereo system. Brand new. Dual cassette decks. Turntable. I could play my records, dub cassettes for friends, make mixtapes with mixed messages for girls. At the midpoint of my 6-month sentence, my parents had gotten me a gift so specifically for me. I was astounded. I knelt down, and my hands glided over the faux wood paneling and the plate glass door that enclosed the stereo components. I didn't understand why I deserved such a gift, and felt a searing wave of guilt and sadness. I recognized my parents' forethought in buying me a stereo. Among the components, between the dual cassette decks and the receiver, was something I hadn't seen before. Wow. I mustered a few words together. Is that a... That's a CD player, my dad said from behind my crouched position. Music is supposed to sound really good on a CD. None of my friends had CD players in 1988. I didn't own any CDs, but from working at the mall and seeing them in their giant oblong cardboard boxes, I knew that they were more expensive than records and tapes. I skipped over the CD player to look at the record player and the remote control on top of it. That's a remote control. Have you ever seen a stereo with a remote control? I hadn't. I now had a nicer stereo for my bedroom than my parents had for our living room. I didn't know what to say. Still lingering in the doorway, my dad continued with his showroom sales pitch. I asked someone at work what kinds of speakers were good, and he told me that Advent speakers were very good. I was sold, but my silence sounded like indifference. I didn't say anything because I was too grateful. I didn't say anything because I, inmate Phuc Minh Tran, incarcerated at 1010 Harriet Street, couldn't believe that I got a brand new stereo for Christmas in the midst of being grounded. We can set it up when we get back from New York. I was still silent, and the void of words created a space between us. My father retreated away from that gap, and as he walked down the hallway, the gap widened into a chasm. I didn't thank him, and his shuffles put a distance between us that gulfed too wide for words. Muffled in the silken gauze of the ineffable, we lost an opportunity to connect with a kind word, with tenderness, as father and son. Maybe we would have failed anyway, but I didn't even try. We didn't talk about how he felt, or how I felt, or where our relationship was. We never did. I had never heard my father say, "I love you," to me, and maybe this was his fumbling way of saying it. I didn't give him a chance to say anything, and I didn't acknowledge my suspicion that the magnanimity of the gift was my parents' attempt at mending our relationship. "We see you," they wanted to say. "We see you listening to music, we know that you love it, and this is for you because we love you." Their kindness was confusing for me, and it was easier for me to play the simple role of a teenager being angry with his parents. It was easier for me to fixate on the cool new stereo, and not to think about why I got a cool new stereo from my parents. In the midst of my own changes, I wasn't able to change my perspective on my mom and dad, to consider that my parents might be changing. Maybe they wanted to change the story of parents being the antagonists in their children's lives. We didn't have the script for that scene. I missed the cues for the dialogue, and the curtain closed on another moment of disconnection. March 1989, Carlisle High School. School was stomping along. On my way to gym class, I stopped at my locker to get my gym uniform, which was still unwashed months later, and varying shades of off-white. No white socks. I couldn't find my gym socks. Fuck. Fucking Liam had borrowed them again earlier in the week and hadn't returned them. It was the third time this had happened, and our gym teacher strictly enforced the three strikes policy. Improper gym uniform, three times in a marking period, and you failed gym. And this was my third gym class without the full uniform. I had everything except the socks, but that didn't matter to Coach Woods. In the gymnasium, I walked past Coach and his clipboard, hoping he wouldn't notice or would give me a pass with some unheralded kindness. No chance. He called our names and rattled off the uniform as he checked them off. Tran, white t-shirt, green shorts, white socks, light-soled sneakers, athletic supporter. Tran, where are your white socks? Sorry, I forgot them. I lent them to someone else so that he could wear them. Coach didn't acknowledge my explanation. You know this makes three, Tran. You'll get a fail for this marking period. Fucking fuck. I had black socks on, but I needed to have white socks. Fucking white socks. I was going to fail gym class and not make honor roll. But I made honor roll with my academic grades, right? Would I really be denied honor roll because of a technicality? In the days leading up to receiving my report card, I thought about trying to forge the honor roll stamp, but it was too mechanical, and I had never forged anything. It would be too much of a gamble. Besides, my parents might understand the absurdity of the policy. They bought me a stereo while I was grounded, right? They didn't yell at me when I got arrested, right? There was a chance they might be sympathetic, and I wagered on it. The chips were down. The Monday that our report cards came out, I checked to see if, in the Byzantine bureaucracy of Carlisle High School, someone had forgotten about my failing gym. No such luck. The U, unsatisfactory, for gym, was clearly printed. The absence of honor roll also lingered there, striking in its absence. At least my other grades were good. Maybe my parents wouldn't notice. I thought about the stereo again and the kindness behind it. It was genuinely benevolent. Maybe my father would surprise me again. At dinner time, my mother had made garçon with rice, stir-fried chicken, and broccoli. My brother and I sat opposite each other, and my parents flanked us at the ends of the table. "Did you get your report cards today?" my father asked. My brother and I presented them. As my father reviewed Lou's grades, my vision tunneled and my mind raced. I was 1 month from finishing being grounded, and now this bullshit. I braced myself for further incarceration. Would they sentence me to another 6 months? That I could take, especially since I wasn't really trapped in my room anyway. But I started to wonder if he would ground me for a year. But still no matter. I felt confident that even that I could endure, whatever sentence he doled out. My father perused my report card. "That's good. All A's. That's very good. Why is there a U for gym?" My brother passed the rice to me. I forgot white socks three times this marking period, so I was marked unprepared. I had everything else. Can you believe that? I had socks. But you need to have white socks. Crazy, right? Those gym rules. But you do have white socks. I do, but I lent them to Liam. And he forgot to give them back to me. That happened three times. I couldn't explain to them the adolescent politics behind lending Liam my socks. Liam was the first person who had stood up for me. I owed him. If Liam needed something, I gave it up. We had each other's backs. "Oh, Liam Mahoney, I like him," my mother chimed in. Well, that was a good sign. I lent socks to a kid who my mother liked. "Your grades are good, though. You still made honor roll, right?" my dad asked. "Well, technically, no." I hoped that I could misdirect him with further explanations. But
Colleges won't look at honor roll anyway. As long as I have the grades and my SATs are good, this won't matter in the long run. It's just one marking period out of the six that we have. So in 4 weeks, I'll be back on the honor roll. It really is just a technicality. I'm just not on honor roll this marking period, but I will be again. No big deal. God, that was a fucking ramshackle defense. A long pause hovered over the table after I finished my lawyering. So no honor roll? My dad asked. No. He sat in silence, the bowl of rice wafting steam before him, holding the report card, unable to look at me. My mother and brother had begun eating, trying to ignore the situation and diffuse the heavy silence by not chiming in. But my father continued to sit there, expressionless, as I tried to read his stubbled face, thinking that I was definitely going to get grounded for longer than I was anticipating. In my mind, I tried to guess how much longer, looking for a poker tell in his expression. I looked at his hands, flat and bone-thin on the table. Suddenly, the end of the table snapped with a loud crack as the blue and white bowls and chopsticks went flying, the bowls breaking. Bits of blue and white ceramic dragons and bats scattered in shards on the floor. Chopsticks skittered with high, rim-shot clacks like a drum roll. My father pushed his chair back quickly. My report card flew onto the floor, covered in food. My father had raised his arms and slammed them down so hard that the leaf at the end of the table had snapped. He had broken the table. His whole face twitched with rage. He and I stood up simultaneously, and he lunged for me, trying to grab my arm. This was definitely not going to be a grounding. I moved quickly to my right as he kept lunging for me, my brother and my mother still seated, though my mother was now Vietnamesing. Honey, please stop. Dear, please stop. Years of playground instincts kicked in from avoiding the bigger kids and bullies. Don't let him grab you. But this wasn't a game. My dad lunged for me again, and again I ran to the right, both of us sliding in our socks. Face to face, he lunged left and I moved left, sliding again on the linoleum. What the fuck is going on? I thought. He stopped chasing me and yanked a kitchen drawer open, brandishing a pair of scissors. Scissors? What the fuck was he going to do with? He lunged for me with the scissors. Did he try to stab me? He swung at me again with a wide arc, scissors pointing forward. Fucking shit, he's trying to stab me. We circled around the broken kitchen table three times, kicking shards of bowls and clumps of rice. Come here! I said come here! He kept lunging at me with the scissors, missing. My mother's cries of stop it and her sobbing were the background to my father's primal grunts as he lunged with the scissors. Huh! 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 His face was crimson, his neck veins bulged against his collar, and his tousled hair lurched upward each time he jumped forward with the scissors. Lou had retreated silently to the perimeter of the kitchen and hid his body around the corner. What the fuck is going on? I ran out of the kitchen and into the nearest room, the bathroom, and locked the door. I backed away from the door, out of breath, and slouched on the toilet. I heard my dad standing outside the door, and he struck it a few times, rattling the flimsy wood. Jesus Christ. He waited outside the bathroom door for a moment and stormed off down the hall. Doors slammed, crashing, splintering sounds. I opened the door and inched toward the noise, which was crackling from my bedroom at the end of the hall. From the hall, I saw my dad, seething with fury. He was snapping my records in half. I felt sick. A small pile of records and their sleeves were accumulating at his feet. Vinyl snapped unevenly in half. Cardboard sleeves bent, hair disheveled, panting. He knew how to hurt me. Everything that I had curated over the last 2 years lay strewn across my bedroom floor, broken and sliced into pieces. After a few album dismemberments, he stopped taking the records out of their sleeves. He snapped them whole until he heard the vinyl crack inside. Some he threw against the wall. Posters and punk show flyers were fluttering down from the wall in large triangular slices, the confetti of destruction. Susie and the Banshees, gone. Public Image, torn. Never mind the Bollocks, ripped. My closet door yanked open,
and the scissors clicked their edges together. My t-shirts began to tear and ribbon as the scissors did their work. My leather jacket was filleted. I was devastated. I couldn't let him know. Don't show him. Boys don't cry. I didn't know whether he would try to attack me again with the scissors. There, in the moment, I felt the reverberations of my uncle stabbing his wife and himself to death. The last time our family was involved in a stabbing, it didn't end well for anyone. I wasn't going to wait around to see what would happen next. I grabbed my skateboard, a flannel shirt, and sneakers by the front door. I was getting the fuck out of my house if I wanted to survive. My face was flush. "Where are you going? Where are you going?" my mom asked, half crying. I didn't tell her because I didn't know. Lou wasn't in my periphery, and I guessed that he had gone into his room and closed his door. Halfway out of the house, I remembered. I had a geometry quiz tomorrow. Shit, was I seriously thinking about that right now? In the scariest moment of my life, in my most primal survival moment, I thought about school. Like Gregor, worrying about how to get to work on time. I paused briefly at the door, stepped back inside to grab my backpack and books, and skated away. It was dusk when I stopped at a payphone on the other side of town. I called Liam. He owed me one since he was the one who'd borrowed my socks. When he got on the line, I told him what happened. "Jesus, yeah, of course. You can stay at my house tonight, but just tonight. Can you come to my window around 11:30? We had a plan. Liam lived in a one-floor ranch house. Thank God for 70s architecture. It was 3 hours until our rendezvous time. I had my skateboard and a backpack full of homework, so I skated a few blocks until I found a bench under a street light. This would do. I studied for geometry and read my English assignment. At 11:30 p.m., I tapped on Liam's window and the pane creaked upward. I heaved my backpack and my skateboard up and over, and I pulled myself through his window. Liam and I spoke in a susurrous hush. "I snuck you a sleeping bag. It's all set up in my closet," he whispered. The sleeping bag was unrolled across the bottom. It looked like a cocoon. "Thanks, man." "You can't stay here tomorrow, though. We should find another place for you to go. What about Grendel's place?" Grendel was an older punk in town, but he was rumored to be dealing from his apartment. I didn't know him that well, and staying in a drug den seemed like a bad idea, even in my situation. "Yeah, maybe I'll call Grendel," I lied. Into Liam's closet I went, where I tried to sleep, but instead spent most of the night stifling my tears in the dark. Unlike the darkness of Christmas Mass, I did not feel like everyone else. I didn't feel united by a common faith, real or feigned. In the worst moment of my life, I wanted to reach out to someone who could give me some insight, some solace, a hug, anything. No one I knew had experienced anything remotely like this. I was alone, in the bottom of Liam's closet, riding the undulations of assorted emotions. My rage and despair opened up into a black chasm, swallowing any latent, childlike need for my father. "Fuck you, Dad. Fuck you. I can't believe you tried to stab me with scissors. What the living fuck? Over a fucking report card? Over gym class? And you, Mom, you couldn't stop him? You couldn't say anything? My friends were the only ones who were there for me." "Gregor, was this what you felt like when you were a big fucking bug and your parents were total dicks? Was this what it felt like to be an insect? To feel small?" I put my head in my arms and I cried. I cried hard for everything, for nothing, for myself, for my parents, for the lives that we were supposed to have, for the stupid life that we did have, for the circumstances that made my father and my mother who they were. I wanted to believe that they were better people. I cried for who they were and who they wanted to be. I cried for everything being so fucked up. I cried because I didn't see any future in front of me except for the bottom of Liam's closet. Whatever life I hoped to have was gone and irreversibly changed. I felt sure of that. I pushed some clothes around to unpack space for myself, and I swore to God that if I found white gym socks in his closet, I was going to punch Liam in the face. The next day in school, I told Connor what happened, and he let me sleep in his room on his floor the next 2 nights. but his parents began to get suspicious. "We gotta find you another place to go," he told me, after school on Wednesday. I was resolved not to go home. At the end of that school day, I intercepted my brother at his bus by the middle school. He was not allowed off the bus, so I tapped on the bus window in the parking lot and got his attention. He looked agitated as he pushed the window down, kneeling on his seat so that his face and fingers leaned over the pane.
"Fook!
Hey, can you do me a favor? Are you okay? Where have you been?" Lou looked worried. I spoke calmly not to alarm him.
"I'm okay. Don't worry about me. Can you go in my closet and see if I have any clothes left? I don't have any clean clothes to change into."
"I don't know. Dad threw away most of your stuff, but yeah, okay. I'll look. How do I get you the clothes?"
"I'll meet you here tomorrow. You can drop them out of the bus window, okay?"
"Okay."
I remembered that my Uncle Ty had gotten an apartment in town and was living with his girlfriend. I called him from a school payphone on Thursday.
"Yeah, of course you can stay with me. Just come over after I get home from work."
Utter relief. No more couch surfing. No more closets and floors.
Lou came through for me that afternoon. I met him at his bus after classes, and he dropped a beige plastic shopping bag out of the bus window.
"I found two old shirts that were in the back of your closet, and I grabbed some other stuff that wasn't thrown away."
"Thanks." I opened the bag. Shirts, boxers, black socks.
Black socks. That was rich.
"Thanks, Lou. I'll talk to you soon, when I have things figured out."
He muttered an unconvincing okay as I stuffed the bag into my backpack. The bus window clacked back up. I raised my hand in a half wave as I skated away to my uncle's apartment downtown. My Uncle Ty made dinner that night, and I didn't have a lot to say.
"Do you have clothes?" He gave a quick flip to the frying pan.
"You can wear some of my clothes too. No worries, man."
"Thanks. Lou found me a few old t-shirts, but I'll need more than a few t-shirts. Thanks again for letting me stay."
"Of course. Your dad is a prick, always has been. And your mom, she's never stood up to him. You know that story about your dad breaking his leg in the motorcycle accident?"
I was half listening, but he didn't wait for my reply.
"You know what really happened? He tried to run over a dog on a motorcycle. That's why he broke his leg and ended up in the hospital for 6 months. What a dick, right? Who tries to run over a dog on a motorcycle?"
I hadn't ever heard that version of the story, but I didn't have the stomach to join in. I hated my father at that moment, for sure, but I was exhausted. Hatred required calories that I didn't have. Ty's girlfriend, Carrie, a Zaftig witchy brunette, was sitting at the counter that separated the kitchen from the rest of the apartment, making small talk about school and going to concerts. And after dinner, she laid out a blanket and a flat sheet on the couch for me.
"We're going to watch a movie. Want to watch with us?"
Ty lit a joint, and its cherry glowed with his deep inhale. He waved the joint in his hand toward me to punctuate, "Watch with us." I nodded. "Sure, why not?" I don't even remember what movie he put on, because I did my homework while the movie played, and I stayed up a little while longer after they went to bed. The next morning, I awoke at 6 a.m., and as I was getting my schoolwork together, Ty shuffled out of his bedroom, shirtless and in boxers.
"What are you going to do with your day?"
"What do you mean?" It was Friday. I unfolded my school schedule to check it.
"No, you dumb shit. I don't mean what classes you're going to. You're not going to school, are you? I'm not your fucking dad. You don't have to go to school. Hang out. Do whatever you want."
I didn't pause. "I do. I do have to go to school. I have two quizzes to take." It reflexively came out of my mouth.
"I'll see you later. Thanks for letting me stay here."
I grabbed my skateboard and clattered off to school, the pavement whirring under my wheels like wings. I went to my classes. I aced Mr. O'Hara's quiz, and I handed in a draft of a paper for Mrs. Ferguson. It felt easy. It felt like when I liked comic books. It felt authentic. My leather jacket with all the studs and punk pins and painted band names was gone. My brand new boots that I had bought with Christmas money and my band t-shirts, gone. My Walkman, my cassettes, my records, all gone. I had lost my protective shell of a leather jacket. No more punk pretenses. That was past tense. I was at school to learn, read books, and figure some shit out. Was this the real me? Stripped of the ability to look like a punk, what defined me as one? Not my jacket, not my clothes. My friends? My enemies? No. What I did determined who I was, not what I looked like or what I liked, my actions and reactions. Did I emerge from the shell? I felt naked and free. Was I now pupa or chrysalis? I felt like myself. And that was what punk was, the freedom to be who I was unapologetically, even if I hadn't chosen it. I thought about my uncle's apartment, sparsely decorated with secondhand furniture, the college dropout's hand-to-mouth existence of weed-smoking and clock-punching as he washed dishes at a restaurant. I thought about Grendel's drug-den apartment, even fewer prospects for him and his future. A few months ago, Connor told me that he was going to enlist in the army. That was his ticket out of Carlisle. Enlisting was not going to be my ticket out of Carlisle, and smoking weed every day and punching a clock was not what I wanted for my life. Punk rock had paved a way for me through my first 2 years of high school, but I was beginning to realize that maybe anarchy and nihilism were not a blueprint for building a future. Punk rock was an explosive for detonating the present so that I could rebuild my future from the rubble. I knew that only school could save me and would be my ticket out of Carlisle, my future's foundation. I would finish high school and dare to dream about college, anywhere that would take me. Get the fuck out of this town. Get me away from my parents. Maybe take Lou with me later when he was old enough or done with school. But I had to get out. That's where you went wrong, Gregor. You didn't get out. You didn't take care of yourself. You kept thinking about your parents and your sister, thinking about how to take care of them. You couldn't see your family, your life, or yourself through a different lens. Your family didn't give a fuck about you, and you didn't see it coming, Gregor. And that blind spot killed you. After 2 weeks, my mother tracked me down at my uncle's apartment. They never looked for me at school. I'm not sure why. Maybe they assumed that I wouldn't have gone. Maybe my dad forbade it. But I was at Ty's apartment when she called, and he didn't lie to her. He was making us dinner again. We had settled into a routine of making dinner, getting high, doing homework. Well, I did homework. He handed me the receiver. It's for you. It's your mom. She's crying. You should talk to her. I held the receiver for a moment, thinking over and over. I was not going home. Fuck them. I was not going home. As soon as I heard my mother's crying and her flurry of Vietnamese entreaties, my heart broke. My father had tried to break me physically with his scissors, and I thought I had steeled myself in the intervening weeks. I thought that my parents couldn't hurt me anymore because I had escaped. I was ready to endure whatever fate inflicted upon me, but I wasn't ready for this phone call. I wasn't prepared to hear a mother's sorrow, my mother's sorrow. I wasn't ready to hear her voice, and beneath it, her love, undiminished and ever present. I wasn't able to bear my responsibility in her pain. The vessel of my heart couldn't hold both my rage for my father and my love for my mother. Like glass subjected to heat and cold, I cracked. Whatever assemblage of myself that I had willfully pieced together fragmented under the tremble of her voice. I knew I had to go home again. I had told myself I wasn't going to cry anymore, yet there I was, on the phone, eyes welling up. I packed my school bag, skipped dinner, and skated home. The closer I got to my house, no, not my house, my parents' house, the more intensely I felt it in my stomach. Rage. Pure rage. Rage at my father for not being reasonable. Rage at myself for not being stronger and resisting my mother's guilt trip. Rage at my mother for not sticking up for me. Not Lou, though. He was the only one for whom I had no bile. I figured that now that I was home, I would be the focus for my father's attention and irascibility. That was fine. I could take the grenade for Lou. I kept both straps of my backpack on as I walked into the house, holding my skateboard, which could shield me from another scissor attack. My dad sat at the dining room table looking over some papers as my mother burst into tears. They had already eaten. He didn't look at me as I strained my ears. Not a word. I didn't hear anything. I didn't say anything. I didn't see a father anymore. I saw the man who had tried to stab me, who had abused me and my brother, who had destroyed my things. I ignored him and he ignored me. I could live with that.
Fope, oh my God, you're home. Oh my God, thank God, Fope.
My mother cried inconsolably. I stood in the living room and let my mother cry into my shoulder. I wasn't going to give my father the satisfaction of seeing how shattered I felt, especially when I had come crawling home already, like an insect.
You need to eat. I made you spaghetti and meatballs.
The spaghetti and meatballs had a hint of nukmam, the ubiquitous fish sauce that my mother used in everything. I ate by myself in silence while my mother sat at the kitchen table, with a hand on my arm, tears running down her face. She kept touching my face while I ate. Her proximity annoyed me, and her outpouring for me made me even more bitter. Where the fuck were you when I was gone? Where the fuck were you when Dad was trying to kill me? I knew she couldn't answer those questions, and I didn't want to ask them, not at that moment. After dinner, I showered and went to my room. No, not my room. It wasn't my room anymore. It was their room. The records were gone. The closet was half empty. I nudged open the trash bag of all the broken and torn things in the middle of the room. I didn't know if my dad had left it there as a reminder, or if my mother had left it there for me to salvage. He hadn't destroyed one thing, the stereo. It sat along the left wall, the wall pockmarked with staples and tape and tacks, telltale signs of posters and flyers now crumpled in the trash bag. The stereo stood untouched as an ironic reminder, a gesture of love that I didn't recall anymore. Lou came to my room as I was getting out my binders to do homework. He sat down in my reading chair.
I'm glad you're home.
Thanks. I wasn't glad to be home, but I didn't want to say that to my little brother. You were supposed to love your father, and he was supposed to love you back. That was the fairy tale I still wanted to believe, but I didn't. I couldn't forget what happened, and I couldn't ignore how I was feeling. I didn't want to hate my father, but I did. The reality of violence, the violence of my reality, pulled me in one direction even as I tried to make it all square up with what I wanted and needed. Even though Lou had witnessed my father's outrage and my flight, I wanted things to seem normal for him. I was 15, but Lou was 12. It was one thing to take him out on Halloween to egg houses. It was another thing to explain to him how much I hated our dad and how I didn't even want to be under the same roof. I loved my brother, and that love kept me from confiding in him. Maybe he could have a better relationship with my father than I did. Maybe I could keep my experience from tainting his. Maybe I didn't have to be a paternal figure to him. In my simplistic love for him, I hoped high school, our family, his life would be better for him. That I could somehow smooth a path for him or warn him in advance so that he could just fall in behind me as I forged ahead. I just wanted it to be different for him, even if all the elements were the same. But maybe it was already too late. There are a few moments in the metamorphosis in which Gregor can be described as happy, and there are moments when he embraces his newly found roachness, when he is not trying to pretend to be someone he no longer is. This joy is punctured by his mother's revulsion for him as her screams drive him back into his room. Finally, on an ill-advised attempt to leave his room, Gregor's father hurls an apple at him, badly wounding his bug body. And Gregor eventually dies from infection. Christ. At least my father had the decency to try to kill me with scissors. During the 2 weeks that I was couch surfing, I went to school, dispossessed of all the things that meant anything to me, stripped of who I thought I was, and of the things that I thought protected me. I kept going to school because I knew where I was happiest, in geometry class, in art class, in English class. I went to my shifts at the mall. Things were surprisingly normal. None of my friends or teachers would have said that anything was different other than my limited wardrobe rotation. My father and I never talked about what happened. And by that summer, our silence with each other was bridged slowly by one-word replies and brief questions. The truce was easier than the truth.
but the dynamic in our household had changed. My parents were my housemates. I didn't rely on them for understanding or support. If I needed that, I had an unruly tribe of friends who would do most anything for me. That was my family. When the next report card came out, I felt a twinge of its secret history. It was the marking period during which I had slept in a closet, on a floor, and on a couch. It was the marking period during which my father had tried to stab me with a pair of scissors. It was the marking period when everything had been destroyed. Even when I had nowhere to live, I went to school. For those weeks, school was all I had. School was the only way I was going to survive. School was the only why I survived. Homework, quizzes, history, chemistry. And here was the report card, the post-mortem. At dinner time, I silently slid the report card to my father across the new dining table with defiant confidence. Painting 1, A+. English 2, A. Geometry, A. Algebra 2, A. Chemistry, A. Western Civilization, A. Physical Education, pass. Absence/tardy, 0. Most important, across the bottom, honor roll. Chapter 9. The Importance of Being Earnest. Junior year of high school, it was the best of lies, it was the worst of lies. It was the age of truths and the epoch of lies. Things that I previously thought were true felt like lies, and the lies that I told myself ended up being true. Sounds confusing, right? It was to me, too. But then I read The Importance of Being Earnest. From the moment I read it, I adored Oscar Wilde's play. I loved how it toyed with the conventional